1946, a young Vermont businessman named Jacob Estee founded the Estee Organ Company. It was a minuscule operation at first, but it grew to be one of the two largest pipe organ manufacturers in the entire Northeast.
The Estee Organ Company had humble beginnings. The first showroom was in the back of a covered wagon. Think of it like a modern company starting in a garage. Historian John Carnahan of the Estee Organ Museum in Brattleboro tells us more.
They were marketers and didn't have any particular interest in music. The story is that there was a maker, a small one person, maybe two or three people perhaps, maker downtown who rented space from him, and they went out of business. He took a look at what they were doing and he said, well, maybe I could sell some of these things. So he put them literally on a wagon and took off and found he could sell them.
It wasn't long before the Estee Organ Company was selling organs all over the country.
During the years when they were making that high back style like that, 1890s, they were shipping out more than 15,000 instruments a year.
Well, that's
how many
interesting.
Workers did you say that?
600 to 700 in the 1890s.
67.
Six to seven.
Oh, six to
yeah, not six.
Seven. Oh, even that.
600. Estee was known for sort of a standard, off-the-shelf, kind of inexpensive pipe organ. Yeah. This kind of organ you could put in an auditorium or a small church, anywhere you want to. Same for this one over here. They did, of course, build a lot of bigger organs. They were especially well-known for residential pipe organs,
yeah.
Most of which, many of which, were player-type organs, where you'd have a player role that you could put
into it. Yeah.
Of the tens of thousands of organs that Estee manufactured, most were small reed organs, the kind of instrument that you could fit in your house or even fold up and fit in the trunk of your car. Still, Estee built a significant amount of larger pipe organs as well. 24 of those were installed in the Pioneer Valley, but we're getting a little ahead of ourselves.
You can probably guess what the major difference between a pipe organ and a reed organ is. One is based on vibrating pipes, the other on vibrating reeds. While both are still technically organs, you would never mistake one for the other. For example, this is a fold-up type reed organ.
This is a full-size cathedral pipe organ. How does a pipe organ actually work? How does it produce sound of such unparalleled complexity, volume, and depth? I sat down with organist, pipe organ repairman, and all-around organ expert Peter Beardsley of Springfield to find out. He was even kind enough to play us a familiar tune to demonstrate.
The pipe organ is a very complicated instrument from what I've been able to find.
Well, it is in a sense in that there are many, many pipes and many switches and things, but it really is a very, very simple mechanism multiplied thousands of times over. That's what it amounts to. Basically, you press a key and a valve opens, or many valves open, to admit air to a pipe. The organ achieved a form that at least looks roughly like what it looks today by about 1400. And in those days, of course, there wasn't electricity. So you pressed a key, a wooden lever was connected directly to the wind chest, which admitted air to a pipe and made a sound. The wind chest is full of air pressure. The air pressure in the wind chest under the pipes is, of course, higher than the outside, the atmospheric pressure. When you press a key, the little leather bellows is suddenly admitted to the outside pressure, which is lower, and so it collapses by the pressure inside the chest, and that yanks the valve away from the hole, which admits air to the pipe. Now, of course, that's all done electrically. Hmm. You'll notice that I do not use the word organ and the word electronic in the same sentence, generally. But the promise, of course, was that the electronics would last a long time and hold up and so forth, because they're supposedly maintenance-free. Well, A, they're not maintenance-free. They need to be regulated and tuned as the digital tone generators, in fact, change their character over the years. Even if the electronic devices were to arrive at a point where they accurately reproduced the sound of a pipe organ, it would still be only the sound of a recorded pipe organ because they're playing through speakers. The organ here has something like 1,100 pipes, 1,100 to 1,200 pipes in it. And this is a smallish pipe organ. That means that there are 1,100 or 1,200 separate sources of the sound.
Despite their numerous drawbacks, electronic organs have one key advantage over traditional pipe organs: affordability. There's no doubt that the rise in cheap electronic alternatives to the pipe organ following World War II was the beginning of the end for the SD Organ Company.
Actually, SD did try to get into the electronic instrument, and that's one over there that was built by them in the 1950s, and it doesn't work, as you say. Yeah. We like to point out that these, some of which are 150 years old, still work.
But it just wasn't enough. In 1960, the SD Organ Factory closed their doors, but the electronic organ was not the sole culprit.
Depression, they didn't lay people off, they kept going, and that's one of the reasons they went out of business, was that they were using up their savings, their capital, just to keep going. World War II came along, of course, and then equipment and materials became difficult to get, and then following the war, electronics coming into popularity, plus other kinds of home entertainment, television being the most prominent, probably.
Of the 24 SD pipe organs that were originally installed in the Pioneer Valley, only five remain. Most are in less than perfect shape, and one at the West Hampton Congregational Church is hardly ever used at all.
I've noticed, I've found a couple, but have you found that these pipe organs, especially the older ones that were constructed pre-electricity, are beginning to be valued more for their historical value than for their musical value, or
yes.
Do they?
Yes, yeah. I think it's very much so. Although that's not universally true. There is, for instance, a little 19th century, I think it's 1867, Johnson in the Church on the Hill in Lenox, that really isn't very interesting musically and gets maintained because of its historical value. But in Germany and in France, that's not the case at all. These instruments are still the musical instruments in their churches and a few other places, but mostly in churches. I had a sabbatical in summer of 2002 and played several of the major organs in Germany and in France. And in every case, it's an instrument that is maintained and used in daily use. Recitals, concerts, church services, community events. There are a few organs that I would call museum pieces around the edges, but that's not what most of them are, certainly.
Today, maintenance of SDs is left to independent technicians. This is partly why a couple are not in the best shape. With no nearby factory of organ makers, there is only a tiny handful of people in the valley capable of repairing the SDs when they go wrong.
I don't really have a particular maintainer, and I'm trying to get some motivation and support from the congregation to have someone come and look at it, because I know there are a bunch of keys that don't work anymore and it needs to be tuned very badly.
In our days, we're used to hearing the organ as background music, accompanying music. There's a whole raft of choir anthem music in the Protestant church that's been written since 1600 that uses the organ as the accompaniment, or it's specifically written for the organ as the accompaniment. Also, it's important to remember that in the early part of the last century, in the early part of the 20th century, the organ was the way that lots of people heard symphonic music, because there were no radios, there were no record players, no CDs, all the stuff that we have now and we take for granted. The way that many people in suburbs and farm towns and so forth heard, say, the new Brahms symphony or the new Beethoven, well, it doesn't go that far back, but certainly the new romantic symphonies, Brahms, Mahler, and so forth, was that the local organist would play them in transcription, that is to say, would play a symphony transcribed, written out so that it could be played on the organ. And so the organ became a very important source of all kinds of music, not just church music, for folks who didn't have access to, say, the New York Philharmonic or the Boston Symphony. Mm-hmm.
So these days we do have all these other ways of hearing music and experiencing those things. Is that really all that's gone into? Because as I've found out, so many organs that used to be maintained and used commonly are just sort of lost, basically.
That's exactly right. That was a major role that the organ had a century ago, which it no longer has. The art of transcription is returning in that there are a few people. I think of David Briggs. David Briggs is a British organist who's taken up residence in Massachusetts, lives somewhere near Boston, in that amorphous end of the state that I don't understand. David has made quite an art of transcribing major stuff. He has a CD out of the entire Mahler, I believe it's the Mahler Second Symphony, played on the big organ in Gloucester Cathedral, England. I myself have just finished a series of recitals when I played the Saint-Saëns Carnival of the Animals. You know, everybody knows the swan from that. And it works great on the organ. It's great fun. And in fact, I am finding, in a sense, recovering the old role of the organ that I just spoke about. I've been playing it for school children. School children, of course, have their iPods and their CD players and whatnot, but this is not the music they're playing, needless to say. They're not playing classical music. My point is that in doing organ demonstrations for groups of school kids, by being able to play something like the Carnival of the Animals, some of which they might know, all of which they find entertaining because it's full of the organ imitating animal sounds. There's a terrific donkey hee-haw at the end of it on full pedal reeds. It's quite a scream. But it has piqued the interest of young children in classical music, in the organ specifically. I have now two very bright students, one 15 and one 16, a 15-year-old girl and a 16-year-old boy, both of whom got their interest piqued in the organ by this kind of program. They're now studying with me, and they're going great guns. They really are the players of the future.
The pipe organ doesn't do for us what it did for Jacob Esty. It occupies a much narrower space in the soundscape of the Pioneer Valley than it did 100 years ago.
But this place is not without value. Rather than acting solely as a means for worship, Esty organs now tell a story. They tell a story of a time before iPods and mass distribution.
A time that we can revisit whenever we hear an Esty pipe organ.